Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSR HealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Hello and welcome. It is so good to connect with you here, connect with you in physical time and space, connect with you in the heart, and welcome you to this community. We're not just sharing this moment together. We're sharing it with so many thousands of other people, and we're inspiring each other. We're letting our enthusiasm for spiritual growth feed on our shared community, to build and help us all move to higher levels of transcendence. And you being here is this eloquent statement that you are prioritizing your own well-being. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're part of our community. And we're going to share with you in the next while some extremely practical techniques for shifting yourself from perhaps a down spiral, perhaps being really dominated by negative thinking, intrusive thoughts, regrets, worries, fears from the past. I'm going to share some highly practical techniques with you in the coming hour. So I'm going to ask you to do, as I always do, keep a journal. Grab your pen and paper, have your device handy, make notes, and see how you can apply these techniques in your life. I know you'll be inspired, but I want you to be motivated as well. So inspiration's great to give us the juice to get us there. Then we want the practical application and a plan to apply these things in our lives. And I'm going to end our time together today by asking you to come up with an action plan, a solid, concrete set of commitments to apply these wonderful life-transforming techniques in your own life. So make sure you grab that notepad or a journal and you are doing active listening all the way through today and coming up with that plan to apply these transformational techniques to your life. My guest today is Steve Taylor. He's the author of many best-selling books, including The Adventure, A Practical Guide to Spiritual Awakening. He's a senior lecturer in psychology at Leeds Beckett University and chair of the Transpersonal Psychology section of the British Psychological Society. His articles and essays have been published in over 100 academic journals and magazines. He also blogs for Scientific American and Psychology Today. His website is StephenMTaylor.com. Steve, what a joy. I'm so looking forward to our connection today.
Hi, Dawson. Great to be with you again.
You know, when I connect with you, it feels like we're connecting in spirit and heart and also at the material level. It's a joy to have all those three things going on.
Yeah.
So, Steve, for those of the people who aren't familiar with your work already, just give us a brief background in how you got here, how you moved through your life quest to becoming the practitioner teacher you are, and some of the really key events that moved you in your journey.
You know, some people come to spirituality later in their lives, sometimes through a transformational event of some form, or through challenges or crises in their life. But for me, which was kind of innate, and it was inside me from a young age. So I feel like my whole life has been a kind of unfolding of who I really am and who I really always was. And it took me a while to kind of understand myself, to understand my kind of natural spiritual inclinations, to allow them to express themselves in my life, and also to integrate them into my life, you know.
And I want to know, was there reinforcement for that early in your life? So you're innately spiritual at an early age, but were you getting any kind of reinforcement from mentors, from people, from parents, from others outside of you?
No, not at all. You know, in fact, the opposite. I got a lot of discouragement and misunderstanding. Well, I kind of learned that I wasn't, you know, really able to talk about my experiences because nobody around me would understand them. So that made me feel quite confused. I mean, my background was completely non-religious, non-spiritual, kind of, you know, working class. So, you know, for a long time, I didn't understand myself, and I thought I was probably crazy, which maybe I am. But no, the only kind of mentorship I got was from books, you know, when I was a bit older, when I discovered books about mysticism and spirituality and religion, and that led me to spiritual groups and spiritual teachers.
Yeah, and I wanted to just interrupt you there because that is such a common experience. Father Andrew Greeley did this major study of spiritual experiences in the 70s, the first big study of mysticism. Oh, yeah. And what he found was that exactly your story is that people have these experiences and they didn't tell their priests, didn't tell their wives, their husbands, their sons, their daughters. They just felt there was no place to put this. And so I mentioned this to emphasize the fact that it's often the case for us. And if you're listening now and you found that there hasn't been a place for your spirituality in your life, that there's no one to talk to, no one to turn to, you think you're crazy, people think you're crazy, you're not alone.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I guess these days it's a bit easier because people can find kindred spirits by the internet, or they can find information about spirituality through the internet. But in the pre-internet age, which I grew up in, it was more difficult, you know, and it took me until my early 20s until I sort of understood that I was a spiritual person and I was having spiritual experiences. And then I had a framework to make sense of myself and to accept myself, which was very helpful.
And then who was your first, like, physical, practical mentor?
My first practical mentor, who was my mentor for many years, was a spiritual teacher I discovered when I was probably about 30 years old. He was a guy who lived here in England called Russell Williams, a little-known spiritual teacher. He was nominally a Buddhist, but he wasn't really a Buddhist. He was kind of outside any particular tradition. He was just a generally spiritual person. And so I used to go, he held meetings twice a week in his house, you know, very small, maybe 8 or 12 people. So I used to go there quite regularly, and partly he had a sort of radiance around him. That was the main reason I went there, was because of the feelings I had in his presence, not so much what he said. It was a feeling of peace and radiance which emanated from him, which was very powerful.
Yeah. And then one of the things you did that we've chatted about before on a number of occasions is you, as you developed your own practice and began to share yourself, you also worked with a population that is in a unique situation, and that's people who are incarcerated or who are confined, they're in prison. And what you've written about in some of your books is the way that these adverse experiences, highly adverse circumstances, what we think of as being impossible places to find spirituality, like a prison, can actually be a catalyst for growth. I'd love you to share that work with us.
That's right. I call that transformation through turmoil. And it came out of my research. I began to do some research. When I got interested in the area of psychology and began to study spirituality from a psychological point of view, I began to do research on spiritual awakenings, transformations of identity that people would go through. And I found that the most common area where people experience sudden spiritual awakening is in the aftermath of intense psychological turmoil or during psychological turmoil. So, yeah, you talked about prisoners, incarceration. That's a particularly intense way in which it can occur. Also soldiers, you know, soldiers due to the trauma of battle, the constant danger of death. Also, a diagnosis of cancer, that's a very powerful trigger of spiritual awakening. Bereavements as well. So really any particularly intense form of trauma. Another one is addiction. A long period of addiction can eventually give rise to a spiritual awakening. In all of these situations, it's almost as if the suffering that people go through, all of the loss, all of the self-loathing and all of the loss of friendships and loss of possessions and self-respect, it kind of breaks down the ego eventually. And when the ego breaks down, there's a space for a new higher self to emerge. There is a latent higher self, which is fully formed and waiting for the opportunity to emerge. So when the ego breaks down, that self emerges like a chick from an egg when it's ready to hatch, and it becomes a person's new self. They are literally different people, you know, living in a different world, looking at the world in a completely new way. And, you know, sometimes they're quite confused by it because they don't, unless they have a background in spirituality, they don't really understand what's happened to them. So, you know, sometimes they go through a period of confusion. They have to integrate their new state into their lives.
Give us an example, a story of one of those people that was particularly striking to you.
Well, one of the most striking cases which I investigated was a woman from Scotland called Eve. And she was an alcoholic. So by the time she was in her 30s, she was drinking, you know, two or three bottles of wine every day. And she moved on to spirits. And slowly, you know, everything in her life began to break down. Eventually, by the time she was 39, she was homeless. And she was living on the streets in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And she, you know, she tried to stop drinking before but couldn't. So she felt that her situation was completely hopeless. You know, she had no hope. She was kind of physically broken down by the alcohol she was drinking. She couldn't walk more than a few paces without stopping. She was sleeping rough on the streets. So eventually she decided that she was going to kill herself because there was no hope at all. And she waited for it. She knew that there was a certain coach that came from, that traveled from Edinburgh to Glasgow every day. So she waited for the coach on the bus and she jumped right in front of it. But luckily the driver swerved and she wasn't injured. And then the police came. The policeman was very kind and said, look, I'm not going to arrest you. I'll take you back to your parents' house. You know, just tell me where you want me to take you. So she said, take me to my parents' house. So when she arrived at her parents' house, her mother knew she was an alcoholic. So she said, you know, I suppose I'll have to give you a drink. So her mother gave her a glass of wine, but she picked up this glass of wine, but couldn't physically drink it. She kept lifting it, putting it down again, lifting it, putting it down again. Then she looked at herself in the mirror. She said, you know, who are you? I don't recognize you. I can't associate myself with the person I'm looking at in the mirror. And she realized that something had changed drastically inside her. And a doctor came and gave her some medication to deal with withdrawal symptoms. But when the medication wore off, she realized that she was a different person. She'd sort of been reborn and the craving for alcohol had just disappeared. She had no more craving to drink after 20 odd years. And it was remarkable. She didn't understand how the craving had just disappeared after dominating her life for so long. And she felt this new sense of connection to everybody around her, this new sense of empathy and this new sense of the beauty of nature, as if sort of everything was heightened and everything was illuminated. And she felt, most of all, she felt this sense of kind of stability and well-being that she'd never known before. And, you know, she literally became a different person living a new life. Now it's probably 20 years since she stopped drinking. Craving has never come back. She started to work with alcoholics in AA and, you know, the main goal of her life became to help others. But she, yeah, that's probably one of the most remarkable stories that I've come across.
So that higher self is there. It's latent. It's who we are intrinsically. And when that ego collapses, it just shines forth. And then these extreme circumstances can make that ego collapse.
Yeah. I sometimes connect it with psychological attachments. I have this concept of psychological attachments, by which I mean external things which give us a sense of identity or which give us well-being. We all have a lot of psychological attachments. It could be ambitions. It could be achievements from the past that gives us a sense of identity. It could be the roles that we have, you know, in our families or in our jobs. It could be our beliefs, possessions. There are a whole range of psychological attachments which give us a sense of identity. And essentially, these psychological attachments are the building blocks of the ego. So when a person goes through a long period of suffering and turmoil, all of these attachments are broken down. You know, they lose ambitions, they lose their roles, they lose their possessions, they lose their emotional attachments to others. And when that happens, it can be breakdown. For some people, it's simply a breakdown. It just causes them more suffering. But for a small number of people, a small proportion of people, it allows a new self to be born inside them. Pondered a lot over the question, why doesn't everybody undergo this transformation? Because everybody goes through suffering at some point in their lives, at many points in their lives, but only a minority of people undergo this transformation. And I think that maybe, you know, there are only a certain number of people in this sort of, this latent self who's ready to emerge. Maybe another people that's not fully formed yet, it's still kind of developing or it's not quite ready to emerge. But for others, it does seem to be ready, you know, so it's kind of waiting to emerge.
I wonder if the severity of the crisis might also not be a catalyst. So mild crises may not produce that kind of shift, but major ones do. Like in Alcoholics Anonymous, the part of their model is that often it takes hitting bottom. And we may hit a series of bottoms until we get rock bottom. The very worst of the worst.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think there's something in that. I mean, in my research shows that usually it has to be a very intense form of turmoil. Like a diagnosis of cancer is a big one. Because when you're facing imminent death, you know, it kind of breaks down all of your attachments. The death becomes so real that all of your possessions, all of your achievements, your ambitions, they become meaningless. So you're left face to face with the reality of death and the reality of life, you know. So you become aware of the meaning of life. Or you become grateful for life. And everything shifts, you know, it's like scales fall away and suddenly you're awake. You know, you're living as you know. You know that you should all have this vision of the world. You should have always had this experience, but it's taken an encounter with death, or maybe, you know, maybe a long period of depression or alcoholism to make you, you know, to bring you to this reality.
I like everyone now who is sharing this time with us, with Steve and I. Grab your journal, grab your piece of paper, and I want you to reflect for a moment on what your attachments are. Steve mentioned possessions. Are there possessions you're really proud of? Are you really proud of that vacation home? Are you really proud of that car? Are you really proud of that degree, of that job? Are you really proud of having been honored or recognized in some way for your achievement? And of course, these things will go away, you know, when you're dead. You won't own that car anymore. And you won't own that vacation home anymore, and that achievement will be meaningless. So go ahead and just make a list, quick list of the three things that you might have been using to define yourself with. What are three things that are cloaking your transcendence, that maybe these ego pillars that are holding up that old structure that's standing in the way of your transcendence? And it might also be something like addiction. It might be something like loss. It might be your story about abuse and about deprivation and how things might have been. So there are all kinds of stories. Some of them are horror stories. Some of them are happy stories. And so what are yours? Just take a moment here. We'll just breathe mindfully with you as you write these down. I want you to write down at least three. If you're like most of us, you're going to have about 300. You can go ahead and work on your journal later on, do additional self-reflection. But for right now, we'll just do mindful breathing for a few moments and write down at least three of your big attachments while Steve and I breathe mindfully in resonance with you.
The buzz about emotional freedom techniques, also called EFT or tapping. Millions of people have experienced breakthroughs in their mental, emotional, and physical health with EFT. Over 100 scientific studies show that EFT relieves pain, anxiety, and depression. If you or a loved one is suffering, download the free EFT mini manual at www.tappinggift.com today. That's tappinggift.com. Get your free manual at tappinggift.com today.
Make a six-figure income and help others overcome their deepest traumas, anxieties, and fears. It's easy to have a rewarding career in energy healing, and you can become certified in less than a year. Not sure if you'll like it? Try it. Download a free course sampler at newhealer.com. Taught by expert faculty at newhealer.com, you'll become skilled in techniques validated in over 1,000 scientific studies, and you can even train at your own pace while supporting your own health. So visit newhealer.com. Do it now. That's newhealer.com.
Stuff, stuff, stuff. Where can I contain all of my stuff? How about this? The Container Store, the original storage and organization store. And I found their link on the HealthyLife.net advertiser page. They have containers for everything, including the kitchen, the bathroom, trash and recycling, traveling, spring cleaning, and dorm rooms. Just about everything you can think of to contain your stuff. The Container Store, right on the HealthyLife.net advertiser page.
Your DNA is not your destiny. There are many genes in your cells that are turned on and off by your emotions, your experiences, and even your beliefs. In his brilliant new book, The Genie in Your Genes, best-selling researcher Dr. Dawson Church shows how you can cultivate a stress-free mental state that activates the genes that boost your immunity and energy levels. Voted best health book by USA Book News, The Genie in Your Genes is packed with practical advice on how to apply the science of epigenetics for health and longevity. Get The Genie in Your Genes today.
Shh! Over here. Here's a secret for a virus-free computer. ESET. They've been a pioneer in the antivirus industry for over 25 years. 25 years of innovative, top-rated antivirus protection. ESET's award-winning security solutions provide a safe online experience for over 100 million home and business computer owners. They are so affordable, fast, and simple to use. So be gone, you blue screen of death. ESET's on my computer. If it's not on yours, visit HealthyLife.net's advertiser page and click on ESET now.
Remember, freedom of choice. www.HealthyLife.net.
Okay, you can always pick up your journal later on and keep on with the reflection, but this will give you a good start and think about what might be present in your life that is veiling your radiance, that is hiding your transcendent self, that you're using as an ego structure to support yourself, and that might be obscuring who you really are and the glorious being you might be if you just shone the way you were born to shine when you were a baby, the way you came into this world. So, Steve, thank you for indulging us over there.
No, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
I believe that the more dependent we are on external things for our identity and well-being, the less access we have to our essential identity and well-being. It's kind of like a very kind of proportional relationship. And eventually, you know, we realize that we don't need to depend on anything external, that we have, you know, we have a deep, authentic identity within our own being. And also we have a deep, authentic well-being within ourselves too, that doesn't depend on anything external.
Absolutely. We do that. And we do have that. And the more we actually stop our focus on those external things, the more we realize it. And when you realize it, it's also transformative. You realize it's always there, and it's the foundation of your being. I want to, you know, by the way, Steve has a number of books on this. There's one called The Leap, which I would recommend. And you'll find all his books on different themes. I want to pick up, though, with a really important idea from his book, The Adventure. And what Steve says at the start of The Adventure that so struck me was that there are so many profound ideas in Christianity, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, in Taoism, and we have often been hearing these ideas, been exposed to the ideas from very early ages, and we have heard these parables, we've been moved by them, and yet applying them is so hard. One of them that he mentions in the book, The Adventure, is the whole concept from Mahayana Buddhism is that each of us is the Buddha. So to transpose that onto our previous discussion, the Buddha is within. The Buddha's within everybody. And there's all this ego that is cloaking it. And the theory is that all you have to do is drop the cloak and be the Buddha you inherently are. But what Steve points out is that that's easier said than done. And so that idea is there, that concept is there in Mahayana Buddhism. And yet very, very few people are able to drop the cloak. And so concepts like that aren't enough. Stephen Kotler and Jamie Wheel talk about their efforts in flow, and they point out that Buddhism has produced billions with a B of Buddhists, but very few Buddhas, lots of Buddhists. Christianity has produced billions of Christians, but very few Christs. So these concepts are all there, and yet applying them is so difficult in a practical sense that they make a difference in our lives. So in that book, he has us use 8 simple practices which he believes can really shift our ability to move into these states rather than just hearing about them and having them be theoretically useful in our personal growth. So I'd love to spend some time and actually cover those practices because they are so, they're practical and useful, and they really can help us shift in a way into which the concepts can't. So let's just go ahead and delve into each one of those practices and how we can apply those in our lives.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, I mean, as you said, I was always, when I was younger and I used to go to see spiritual teachers or go to talks by teachers, I was always a bit disappointed that they weren't more practical. I mean, it's easy to say, you know, we're all one, we're all fundamentally enlightened, we just need to allow the enlightenment to express itself. I used to think, you know, so what should I actually do? You know, do I just go home? And then there were some teachers who say, you can't do anything to become enlightened, because when you try to do anything, it inflates the ego, you know, it becomes egotism, and, you know, that takes us away from enlightenment. So I thought, what do we do then? Just sort of watch TV and drink beer? What do we do? Well, you know, so I did want to be practical, as you say. And the first quality I recommend, I mean, these are all qualities that emerge from my research into spiritually awakened people and my own experiences. These are all the qualities which they emphasize most prominently. The first one, which I discuss, is disidentification from the ego, which means essentially stepping out of the stream of thoughts, which normally determines our mood or identity, and realizing that we are actually the observer of our thoughts. So, you know, we step back and watch the stream of thoughts flow by, realizing that we don't have to pay attention to our thoughts. We don't have to believe our thoughts. We can just allow them to flow by. And of course, once we step out of that stream, then the stream is no longer as powerful. It loses momentum. So our thoughts slow down. There's more space between our thoughts. And essentially, we become aware of a deeper identity, which is not ego-based or thought-based. I recommend a couple of exercises. One is what I call the riverbank meditation, which is when it begins with a visualization where I ask people to imagine that they're on a riverbank on a summer's day, and then they're watching the river flow by with a light shining on the stream, on the waves of the river. And then they take the same perspective with their thoughts. They just sit back within their own mental space, watching the stream of thoughts pass by, just like a person on a riverbank watching the river, and they become aware of the space between their thoughts and their essential identity.
Absolutely, and that is a powerful technique to pry us loose from that strongly conditioned ego that we have and then see it with perspective. And the moment you do that, you realize, oh, I'm not that.
Yeah, yeah. It also entails stepping outside the story of your life, because the ego is based on stories. It's about what happened to us in the past, what we plan for the future, what we fear about the future. But we step outside those stories as well, and we realize that, you know, right now, in the present moment, there are no stories. There's just our experience. There's just our awareness. We become free of the past and the future, and we focus ourselves in the present.
And so just being in that present moment, that alone is able to shift you. So make sure you make a note of this in your journal right now as a practice that you can use disidentification with your thoughts and that analogy of the riverbank, just watching them flow by. And the second one that Steve advocates in the adventure is gratitude. And gratitude is so incredibly powerful. We know from a lot of research that it shifts the way our brains work. It makes structures like the insula, which is the central lobe. It's such a big piece of tissue that it's been proposed it should be called the fifth lobe of the brain. And this part of the brain becomes highly active when we're experiencing all of the emotional states that I've got on the wall behind me over here, like compassion, like all this one is very, the very, very top over here. And so when we experience awe, when we experience gratitude, when we experience joy, compassion, that insula in our brain starts to really activate. And so gratitude is able to shift your mood, and it's literally shifting the way your brain functions. So go ahead and share about the importance of gratitude and why you picked that as one of your practices, Steve.
That was one of the big changes I found in spiritually awakened people, that they have this all-pervading sense of gratitude for the small things in their lives and for life itself. You know, that they, I often speak about what I call the taking for granted syndrome. I think most human beings, it's a normal human state to be afflicted with the taking for granted syndrome, not being aware of the value of anything around us, taking everything for granted, including our health, the people in our lives, our freedom, our affluence, and everything. But spiritually awakened people, again, it's as if a kind of veil falls away and suddenly they live in this world of gratitude where everything is precious and everything is valuable. Most of all, life itself, you know, even if you believe that there is some form of hereafter, some form of afterlife, you know, it doesn't take away that the glory and the preciousness of life in this form, in this world, in this body. But there's one exercise that I guide people through in the book, and it's based on the experiences of astronauts. That was one of the big transformations which astronauts went through when they returned to Earth. You know, they felt this new sense of gratitude for life on Earth. One of the astronauts said, I think it was a guy called Alan Bean. He said that since I've returned from the moon, I've never complained about the weather because I'm glad that there is weather. You know, he was glad that the Earth had this atmosphere around that supported life. He said that when he returned to Earth, he would just sit in shopping malls watching people go by. And he said, I was just amazed at the glory of life on Earth, the glory that human beings walk around on the surface of this glorious planet. So I guide people through an exercise where We literally travel to the moon. Well, not literally. In our minds, we travel to the moon. And we look at the Earth from the moon, and we experience a sense of gratitude for this tiny blue planet in the midst of space. We focus on all of the aspects of our lives down there on this planet, all of the people and the places and the activities we love. And we're filled with the same sense of gratitude that the astronauts had. And then we return to the Earth with that sense of gratitude, you know, with a new perspective, all of the aspects of our lives.
So as you're listening, as you're here with us, as we're in this wonderful energy space together, grab your journal again and find the smallest thing which you'd be grateful. Don't pick big, enormous things. Don't pick your job that's been supporting you for the last 20 years. Don't pick your some kind of massively obvious item. Find a small one. Find a tiny one like Alan Bean sitting in the shopping center and watching people walk by and just being in awe of that. What tiny thing can you be in awe of? Take a moment. Steve and I will take a couple of deep, mindful breaths. Let you journal about the tiny things that you might just be explosively grateful for. What are those? Write them down.
You have a to-do list, right? Well, that list may be your biggest obstacle to success. Sure, it contains activities that help you achieve your goals, but it's also packed with time-sucking obligations that are not in alignment with your life's purpose. In a new white paper, Dr. Dawson Church explains the difference between a to-do list and a success list. Download it at successlist.net. Create a success list, and successlist.net will show you how to manifest your dreams at light speed. See successlist.net. Why do you attract the same kinds of people over and over again and look for love in all the wrong places? Scientific research has shown it's because of a personality pattern called your attachment style. Programmed early in your childhood, your attachment style dictates your relationship choices throughout your life. At LovingRelationshipsNow.com, Dr. Dawson Church demonstrates the three basic styles. A free quiz at LovingRelationshipsNow.com identifies the attachment styles of your friends and loved ones. Visit LovingRelationshipsNow.com.
Have you heard the buzz about emotional freedom techniques, also called EFT or tapping? Millions of people have experienced breakthroughs in their mental, emotional, and physical health with EFT. Over 100 scientific studies show that EFT relieves pain, anxiety, and depression. If you or a loved one is suffering, download the free EFT mini manual at www.tappinggift.com today. That's tappinggift.com. Get your free manual at tappinggift.com today.
If you like to spend your television viewing time learning about some of the things that you may have missed in history class, or if history was your favorite subject, then you should check out the link to the History Channel on the HealthyLife.net advertiser page. Order DVD sets by series or by subject matter right from our homepage while you still enjoy your favorite HealthyLife.net show.
Have you heard the buzz about emotional freedom techniques, also called EFT or tapping? Millions of people have experienced breakthroughs in their mental, emotional, and physical health with EFT. Over 100 scientific studies show that EFT relieves pain, anxiety, and depression. It works quickly and has no side effects. If you or a loved one is suffering, download the free EFT mini manual at tappinggift.com. That's tappinggift.com. Don't suffer when help is at your fingertips. Get your manual at tappinggift.com today.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Okay, and by no means stop there. Make that list long. I know when I write down my gratitude list, I write down sometimes, one day I began writing down things that I didn't stop for like 8 pages. But you know what I did at the end of that 8 pages? I left 2 more pages. All things that might occur to me. So when you have your list written down, leave lots of space at the end, and you'll find there are infinite things to be grateful for. Steve, what next? What are some practices that can really help us shift in a practical way?
The next quality I focus on is presence. which we already talked about a little bit. But presence, you know, it's one of the fundamental qualities that arises in spiritual awakening. The future and the past recede in importance, and the present becomes more important to us. And, you know, there's a change in perception too. When we become present, the world becomes more real, more beautiful. We feel more connected to it. We seem to transcend separation. And, you know, nature especially becomes especially beautiful. And, you know, we feel a tremendous sense of connection to nature. I sometimes talk about the alchemy of attention. When we bring our attention into the present moment, we, you know, there's a shift in perception. Again, as if a veil falls away. One useful concept I highlight in the book, I talk about the three A's, or the three states of being. And they are abstraction, absorption, and awareness. And I believe that, you know, human beings spend their whole life shifting in and out of these three different states. At any one moment, we're in one of these states of being. And sometimes we're in two of them together. Sometimes we may be in a mix of, you know, absorption and abstraction. So I ask people to think about, and the listeners can do this right now. You know, I'd like you to think about how much time in a typical day you spend in a state of abstraction. And by that, I mean, you know, when your attention is immersed in thoughts in your head, when you're daydreaming or thinking about the future or the past, how much time do you spend in that state of abstraction with your mind immersed in your mental chatter? Then the second state is absorption. And that's when I ask people to think about how much time do you spend in a state where your attention is absorbed in an activity or a distraction or entertainment. So it could be when you're working and your mind is immersed in the duties of your job. It could be in your free time when you're reading a book or watching TV or, you know, on your phone, you know, scanning through the internet. So how much time in a typical day do you spend in a state of absorption? And finally, I ask people, or I'll ask the listeners now to think about how much time do you spend in a state of awareness? And awareness is when your attention is focused on your surroundings and your experiences in the present moment. You know, when you're fully aware of the reality of your surroundings, fully aware of the reality of your experience, you know, without being immersed in daydreams, without focusing your attention in a distraction or an activity. So I ask people to think about how much time in a typical day do you spend in each of those three A's. Usually people tell me that they spend the least amount of time in a state of awareness. Because, I mean, obviously, you know, we have to spend a lot of time in absorption for our jobs, or, you know, that's the way we spend our free time as well. But we don't tend to spend much time in that state of awareness, you know, when we're fully aware of the taste of food, or fully aware of the beauty of nature, fully aware of how we feel right now. So yeah, generally people spend the least amount of time in that state of presence or awareness.
And as you do your own self-reflection here, then you can just start to notice how much of your time you spend in these things. And what you don't want to do is use this as a cudgel to beat yourself up, saying, oh, I don't spend enough time in awareness. Just noticing is becoming mindful. And mindfulness alone, just becoming mindful, is likely to bring you into awareness more often. So you can ask yourself, like, when I'm taking a break from work, say I'm just riding my mountain bike in the hills nearby, I might ask myself, am I in awareness? Am I noticing? Or is my mind cranking away on the work that I have just supposedly left to take my mountain bike ride? So just noticing, just becoming mindful is all we're asking here. There's no need to evaluate it or criticize yourself for doing one or the other. Just be mindful. And mindfulness alone is likely to lead you into more time in awareness.
That's right. Yeah. I suggest that people should give ourselves I call it a gentle mental nudge. We should give ourselves a gentle mental nudge back into the present. So we just sort of check in with ourselves. And if you're in a state of absorption or abstraction, just bring yourself gently back into the present moment. And it's very easy to do. And the more often you do it, the more habitual, the easier it becomes, the more normal it becomes to live in that state of presence.
Yeah. And you discover it's delicious. And there's so much to be savored in the present moment. What next? What's the next practice we can use?
The next one is altruism. And again, this is one of the qualities which naturally arises in spiritual awakening. Awakened people sometimes say that they shift from a mode of taking from the world to a mode of giving to the world. And altruism is quality that, like all of these qualities, can be cultivated. So I suggest a number of practices, some really simple, basic, everyday practices. There are three simple ones that I suggest to begin with. One of them is what I call respectful attention. And that means that in your daily life, everybody that you encounter should receive your respectful attention. Even if it's just even if it's a bus driver, a cashier at the supermarket, somebody who's waiting in the queue with you, in the line with you. Everybody you encounter, you should give them your respectful attention. You should engage with them. You should look at them, smile, express your gratitude. And that's a very simple way of practicing altruism. All altruistic activities give you good feeling. You know, altruism is a really positive experience, both for the person who receives it and the person who gives it, and also for people who witness it. And the second practice of that kind I suggest is, I call it radical friendliness. And that means that whenever I practice this myself quite frequently, and I find it really effective. Whenever I'm in the line at the bank or at the bus station or the train station, wherever I'm in a taxi, wherever I'm on a bus sitting next to somebody, I always make conversation with them. I've become a kind of a specialist at everyday chit-chat. So I love to make small talk with people. And, you know, I found that people always respond in a friendly way. And I always end up having lots of really nice conversations with people, very usually quite brief, but really friendly exchanges with strangers. And it creates a bond. You know, if you do that throughout your day, you're creating a whole network of connection every day, a whole network of emotional bonds with other people. And it creates a really powerful resonance, you know, around you that probably spreads. You know, the people who receive your friendliness become friendly to others, and it has a rippling effect that spreads everywhere.
It does.
That's the third practice.
That one called emotional contagion, where one person's good humor and goodwill infects those around them, which in turn affects those around them, which in turn affects those around them as well. So
it's a story. Have you ever heard the story of the taxi driver who made a whole town happy?
No.
The taxi passenger who made a whole town happy. He or she arrives at a train station, hops in a taxi, and immediately starts making conversation with his taxi driver, you know, asking him about his family, you know, about his hobbies and so forth. And at the end of the journey, he says, wow, I felt so safe in your taxi. That was a really safe journey. You're a really good driver, really. I'm really grateful to you. And the taxi driver is in a good mood. So people get in his taxi, and he's friendly to them. He speaks to them about their hobbies and family. And it spreads. So everybody who gets in his taxi is in a good mood. So they spread it to their friends, everybody else they encounter. So by the end of the day, the whole town is in a good mood because of
this. Never underestimate the power of that little thing you say to other people. It can make such a difference. And there are many, many human stories about this. So once we've begun to practice this connection with others, this altruism, what do we move on to next?
Then we move on to acceptance, which is another very important spiritual quality. And by that, I mean not resisting any of the aspects of your life situation or any of the aspects of life itself, including the fact that we grow old and eventually die. We have to accept the reality of our predicament. But I mean, a lot of people live in a habitual state of resistance. You know, they decide they don't like certain aspects of their life. They don't like their jobs or the chores they have to do. They don't like the people they have to live with or the environment they're in. So they live in a habitual state of resistance, which creates a sense of conflict between them and reality, or between them and life. So I recommend a process of, you know, turning resistance into acceptance, which is based on, you know, a visualization process. We imagine that we're connected to, there's a kind of bond that connects us to a certain aspect of our lives. It creates resistance because it's so tight. So then we let go of the bond. We breathe out acceptance. We feel a sense of openness, and we embrace the reality of every aspect of our lives. It doesn't mean that we don't need to change our lives, you know, because there are certain aspects of our life which may need to be enhanced or changed. But we need to accept the reality first before we make the changes.
Yeah, there's just that alone releases all the psychological pressure that we may have been putting on ourselves and others to change. And that alone gives us a much more relaxed life.
That's right. Yeah, when we let go of resistance, there's a feeling of relaxation. You know, it always creates tension when we resist aspects of our lives.
And then integration.
Integration. By that, I mean integration with the body or harmony with the body. You know, there's a sort of slightly checkered history in spiritual and religious traditions in relation to the body. And there's some traditions see the body as a kind of enemy that needs to be tamed and repressed. Other traditions suggest that the body is a kind of illusion, you know, because it's made of matter and the physical world is a kind of illusion. But I found in my research that spiritually awakened people always develop a very positive attitude to the body. After their awakenings, they start to take more care of the body. They start to exercise more. They start to care about diet. Then they become aware that the body is sacred. You know, the body is not an enemy. It's actually pervaded with spirit. It's an expression of spirit. So they feel this sense of harmony and integration with the body. So I suggest a couple of exercises to enhance, to create a sense of harmony with the body. Meditations, where we perceive the body as sacred. Another thing about the body is that it's always present. You know, the mind can be elsewhere, but the body is always here physically in the moment, in the world. So that, you know, we can use the body as a tool to help us become present.
Yeah, absolutely. And that habit of then moving into loving and living in your body is very powerful and very different from the distance we get of thinking our body is something to be manipulated and shifted and changed. So that alone is going to really, really help us have a very different experience than what we'd otherwise have. Take a moment now and think about how you see your body. Are there ways in which you could move to greater acceptance, integration, living fully in your body, accepting your body, and that after awakening state that Steve described, where we see our body as sacred? Is there a lesson in this for you? Is there a way in which you could perhaps shift your perception of your body here? Make a note of that in your journal as Steve is sharing the last couple of the practices that he recommends in the adventure.
The buzz about emotional freedom techniques, also called EFT or tapping? Millions of people have experienced breakthroughs in their mental, emotional, and physical health with EFT. Over 100 scientific studies show that EFT relieves pain, anxiety, and depression. If you or a loved one is suffering, download the free EFT mini manual at www.tappinggift.com today. That's tappinggift.com. Get your free manual at tappinggift.com today.
Everyone knows that losing weight fast is dangerous. In fact, the U.S. Government Center for Disease Control recommends losing no more than 1 to 2 pounds a week. But is that true? Startling new research shows that people who lose weight rapidly often have better long-term results. Now, award-winning researcher Dr. Dawson Church and registered dietitian Karen Donaldson team up to review all the evidence at 10poundsaweek.com. Download their free report at 10poundsaweek.com. That's 10poundsaweek.com. Make a six-figure income and help others overcome their deepest traumas, anxieties, and fears. It's easy to have a rewarding career in energy healing, and you can become certified in less than a year. Not sure if you'll like it? Try it. Download a free course sampler at newhealer.com. Taught by expert faculty at newhealer.com, you'll become skilled in techniques validated in over 1,000 scientific studies, and you can even train at your own pace while supporting your own health. So visit newhealer.com. Do it now. That's newhealer.com.
Radio Your Way. HealthyLife.net.
Your DNA is not your destiny. There are many genes in your cells that are turned on and off by your emotions, your experiences, and even your beliefs. In his brilliant new book, The Genie in Your Genes, best-selling researcher Dr. Dawson Church shows how you can cultivate a stress-free mental state that activates the genes that boost your immunity and energy levels. Voted best health book by USA Book News, The Genie in Your Genes is packed with practical advice on how to apply the science of epigenetics for health and longevity. Get The Genie in Your Genes today.
The penultimate practice, well, the penultimate quality is dissolving psychological attachments, which we spoke about earlier in relation to transformation through turmoil. And this quality, you know, again, it's something which is recommended by every spiritual tradition. They all suggest that we shouldn't depend on anything external for our well-being or identity. So I recommend there's a meditation I take people through which allows us to let go of our psychological attachments. First of all, we recognize the things that we are attached to, a bit like we did earlier in the exercise. We recognize what our attachments are, and we all have some of them. You know, only the most enlightened people, you know, completely free of psychological attachments. So I give them actually a questionnaire, an attachment questionnaire, where I ask them to look through these attachments and to rate how attached they are to these things. Whether it's ambitions, or it could be, you know, more overt kinds of attachment, like attachment to social media or to the internet or to food or to coffee. I could be in that physical addiction. And then I suggest a couple of methods by which they can release these attachments, mainly through this meditation where, again, it begins with a visualization and people gradually let go of each attachment one by one. And at the end, there is nothing left. All that's left is their own being, their own awareness. And they realize that the essence of being holds a natural quality of well-being, which means that we don't need to seek happiness outside ourselves. We just need to return to that source of well-being deep within us.
After you cover the final one, I'd like to also check in with you about which of these is the most active area of your practice right now. Which of these are you really working with in terms of your own growth? So let's go ahead and cover the last one here, and then just a personal glimpse of how this is working for you.
The last one is acknowledging and accepting our own mortality. And again, that emerges from my research, because I found that becoming aware of the reality of death can be in itself transformational. That's why people who are diagnosed with cancer have spiritual awakenings. Because, you know, on one level, becoming aware of the reality of death gives us a sense of perspective. It makes important things become more important and trivial things seem more trivial. So we become more aware of the importance of love, altruism, spirituality, and so forth. But the kind of trivial things like, you know, like acquiring possessions and, you know, caring excessively about our appearance and keeping up with the neighbors, so those things are not important anymore. But also death gives us a sense of gratitude, makes life precious. It also makes us very present-centered, because the future and the past become meaningless. And it also helps us to let go of psychological attachments, because they no longer have any importance in relation to death. So I guide people through three practices to gently encourage them to face the reality of their own mortality. One of the exercises is what I call the year to live exercise, when we have to imagine or face the fact that we're going to die a year from now on the same day, on this date in 1 year. So we have to change our lives or decide what changes we would make. And I also recommend that people should visit cemeteries. You should go to your local cemetery, sit there on a bench, contemplate the reality of your life, the reality of death, contemplate the beauty and the preciousness of life. And when people we know encounter death, you know, when they go through their own death process, we should support them, share their company, share their journey. And, you know, and if we do gain an enhanced awareness of mortality, it becomes enriching, and has an awakening power.
That is just such a powerful practice, because again, that is part of our incarnational cycle. We will have that time when we're becoming older, when our body's getting more frail, and the eventual process of death. And it's striking that in people like awakened masters, you see them doing death very gracefully. One of my favorite photographs is called The Last Smile, and it's Paramahansa Yogananda. And it's this beautiful smile who's standing there in the ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Los Angeles, and is giving this beatific smile to his followers. And that was an hour before he left the body. So we want to be that happy.
Yeah.
At the hour of death.
Hmm.
Yeah.
People do generally let go of fear of death. Once we become spiritually awakened or developed to some degree, fear of death starts to abate, you know, and as you say, hopefully it will abate to the point where we can welcome and embrace it as a natural, you know, a natural process.
And then, Steve, just in the last few moments, which of these areas are you personally working with in your own life right now?
I'm working on attachment, partly because when you publish a new book, you've been through this.
Absolutely.
You know, you want your book to succeed, and there's some pressure from the publisher to help your book to succeed. So I get a little bit attached to it. You know, it's a bit like a child. You know, you feel responsible for your child, and you're kind of feel proud of your child. And also you get engaged in social media more, and you know, there's a lot of activity. So yeah, I guess I'm working on that moment. There's, you know, the sort of achievement and success and those concepts of those kinds of attachments.
Yeah. And it's interesting that we have material lives. We have material things going on. And we also want to see this kind of work get to lots of people. I know it's highly motivating for me when I see people suffering. I think if only they knew the richness of experience available to them in these awakened states, that so much of the suffering would just disappear. So I think for those who've moved into those states, it's a very powerful motivator. And we're not goal-oriented in the way in which we might have been at an early, it's like when we were building a career or something like that. But the suffering of the world, I think, does weigh on us. And we'd love to see people have the tools to release it.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah, it's a kind of altruistic process, isn't it? Yeah, I feel a desire to share my insights to help others. But I think occasionally my ego can get involved in it as well, to some extent. So, you know, that's what I'm working on.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is that there's always the next thing to work on. So we think we've reached the pinnacle of awareness, and then there's the next thing to work on. So, and then again, when you're, say, maybe in a very successful life, and you've mastered a lot of your challenges, then there's the body, and the body is becoming more frail, and then you're moving toward that end game. Steve, I'm so grateful to you for your heart, your wisdom, your love that just shines through what you say and what you do. It's been such a joy to connect with you today. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Doss. It's been a pleasure. Great talking to you again.
Thanks so much again. And please do these exercises. Don't just be inspired. Be motivated. Go ahead and make this self-inquiry part of your growth. And ask yourself about these eight areas of life. What can you do? How can you apply these in your life? What will you do next? What next steps can you take to actualize these in your experience? So thank you so much for being part of this conversation. Thank you for being part of this community. I look forward to connecting with you when we meet again.